President Trump's proposed budget invests heavily in the military and border security, but cuts the EPA by 25% and diverts money from Medicare and Social Security to building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. Most news reports predict that the proposal is dead on arrival, but it's clear from statements made by Budget Director Mick Mulvaney that, quote, Mr. Trump has, for now, given up on balancing the budget over the next decade. If you take the president's budget and factor in the two-year budget agreement Congress struck last week, the increase, according to the Wall Street Journal, would push the federal deficit above $1 trillion next year and $7 trillion over the next 10 years. Joining me now is Kinderhook Republican John Faso, who represents the 19th Congressional District. Welcome back.
Good morning, Susan.
So interesting times.
Yes, they are.
Is the era of austerity over?
Well, certainly, I'm not sure that we were in austerity before this, but the two-year budget agreement that I supported in Congress last Friday certainly sets the table for the upcoming appropriations process. And the president's budget was largely prepared prior to that agreement being instituted. So I think that much of what's in that proposal is dead on arrival. But the bottom line is that the two-year budget agreement takes a big step towards rebuilding our military. General Mattis, who's the Secretary of Defense, had said to us very strongly, in fact, back at our retreat 2 weeks ago, he said that he had to have this $700 billion number because the military, in essence, since 2012, has been reduced by 20%. And in order to get that, we had to compromise with the other side, which wanted additional spending for priority areas that they felt were important.
Well, and compromise is not a dirty word, but the Republicans in Congress were loath to compromise and pass spending bills under Obama, pointing to the debt crisis. Yet they're voting for spending under Trump and making that same debt crisis worse. And that seems to be the definition of hypocritical.
So here's what I think we have to do. We have to step back a second and take a look at the defense and the non-defense discretionary budget. That defense and non-defense discretionary portion of the budget is about 28% of federal spending. 72% of federal spending is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the debt. And indeed, and from my post on the Budget Committee, I can tell you that that portion of the budget, the so-called mandatory portion of the budget, is growing much faster than the defense and the non-defense discretionary portion of the budget. So that being said, the trillion-dollar deficits are not sustainable. We have got to really roll up our sleeves and reduce this deficit because it is going to – that a deficit of that side is going to crowd out private sector investment. And it's going to make it much more expensive for our kids and grandchildren. So we've got to do something about it.
So do you think it was hypocritical then?
I think it's that was then and this is now, and you could call it hypocritical. You know, I've been here for a year, and I can tell you that the most telling situation in Congress for both sides is to kick the can down the road. Few people want to make the tough decisions today. Because that would disappoint people, and that might cause political jeopardy, whatever. My attitude is look, we've got to make these tough decisions, because the politics is one thing, but the soundness and safety of our economy and our currency, that is something much bigger.
One more question about the financial situation. You did not vote for the tax plan. I want to make that clear, because
right.
Some people think you did, but you did not. You did vote, however, for the two-year continuing resolution, which
yes.
we're talking about, which you admit doesn't help the looming national debt. Was the tax overhaul fiscally responsible, considering it's being followed by these spending increases?
So I think you have to put this in context as well, Susan. We were growing at too slow a rate. We cannot sustain the needs that people want for the government and for the country. And pay for our defense needs, et cetera, when we have a slow growth economy growing at less than 2% a year. The hope and the expectation, frankly, in the last few quarters are giving us some credence in this, that the tax plan and the regulatory relief that is rippling through the economy is going to cause the animal spirits of capitalism to renew and to awaken and to bring about more private sector investment and more economic growth. When you grow at 3% or more, or even 4%, it's a heck of a lot better, easier to balance your books and to reduce those deficits if you have a 3 or 4% growth than if you have a 2% or under growth. So there's a lot of benefit that we're going to see from the tax bill. My vote against it had to do with other reasons relating to SALT, which you and I have discussed.
We've talked about that, sure,
extensively.
All right. So why don't we move on to infrastructure? $1.5 trillion infrastructure proposal released Monday. The federal government will contribute $200 billion of that. The remaining would come from state and local governments and private industry. When I heard about it, I thought, would you be disappointed in that? Because I know you were looking forward to seeing this proposal.
Well, I think the issue here is the president's plan assumes that there are public assets that could be sold or privatized over a long term on a long term basis to the private sector, which would invest and bring a gusher of new money into state and local governments to fund infrastructure improvements. And this can work with certain public facilities like airports, or it could work with bridges or water and sewer systems. Anything where you have a recurring source of revenue every year or every month, that recurring source of revenue is going to be the inducement to bring private sector capital in to purchase or lease on a long-term basis public assets, modernize them, invest in them, and the public sector gets the investment of that money.
So we would like sell Kennedy Airport.
You could sell or long term lease Kennedy or LaGuardia, or you could do it with bridges. This is routinely done around the world, in Europe and in all places like Australia. They have done this very extensively and done it well. And Kennedy and LaGuardia, for instance, are not exactly models of efficient modern infrastructure. So if you go around the world, you'll see examples of airports, for instance, that are much more conducive to 21st century travel.
So you think this could work?
Well, I think it can work in where you have those assets that could be privatized, or where the private sector wants to invest in a long-term lease to own and operate the facility. But the problem is that we're not going to get this doesn't solve the financing problems for the public facilities for which you can't privatize or enter into a long-term lease arrangement with the private sector. So I think the Democrats are rightly saying we need a new revenue source to pay for roads and bridges and other things, other infrastructure that we need. In rural areas, for instance, it's very difficult to find the type of public assets that could be readily privatized in order to generate revenue that could be invested in new infrastructure.
So what do you think about the possibility then of raising the gas tax?
Well, I think everything is on the table. I have not proposed that, but I do think that when you look at the long-term funding structure, for instance, of the Highway Trust Fund, the Highway Trust Fund is being depleted. In fact, between 2020 and 2027, the Highway Trust Fund is going to run a deficit of $123 billion because the gas tax is not, because of better vehicle mileage, electric cars and the like, we're not getting the revenue into the Highway Trust Fund that we have previously done. And so many people are suggesting that.
So would you vote for a gas tax if it is proposed by the White House?
Well, I'd have to see what it says and how they frame it and what the source of revenue is. The key is you've got to be able to persuade the public that if their taxes are going to be used for the purpose the government is saying, and many people are rightfully skeptical of that.
So we're running out of time quickly, but I want to ask you a few questions about what's been unfolding at the White House on the Russia investigation.
Yep.
I think a lot of people want to hear that you will publicly condemn any move to fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Can you do that?
Well, I've already said that. I think that Director Mueller should be given the opportunity to finish his investigation. There, notice there are virtually no leaks that are coming out of his investigation, and from everything that I hear and see, the investigation is proceeding apace. So I don't think that removing him is justified whatsoever. I also don't think, though, that passing a law saying that the executive can't remove an official appointed by the Justice Department, I'm not sure that's constitutional either, but I don't support removal of Director Mueller.
What do you think of General Kelly's decision to allow Rob Porter to work in the White House?
It's inexplicable to me how they can have someone without a security clearance in that position for that length of time. This wasn't just a temporary thing. This was a year. Now, regardless of, and I don't know Mr. Porter, but obviously he should not have been working there without that security clearance.
Do you think General Kelly should continue in the job?
That's not for me to say. I think that he has brought a level of order to the White House, which previously didn't have such arrangements and such order. So I think this is up to the president, obviously, but I think General Kelly hasn't fully explained the circumstances that allowed him to keep Mr. Porter in that position for that length of time.
I know I'm pushing my luck, but one more question. Your colleague John Katko endorsed Senator DeFrancisco for governor this week. Who are you endorsing for governor?
Right now, I'm not endorsing anyone. I remember I did that once myself back in 2006.
I seem to recall that. Yep.
John DeFrancisco is a fine individual. I've known him for years, but I'm just not ready to make an endorsement in that race. But I can tell you, I think John DeFrancisco has a fighting spirit, and he certainly is smart, and he knows the issues, and we would be well served with him as the governor.
Congressman John Faso, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.